Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Remember the before times? Mom Valerie Brueggemann does.
We have a second grader, and before COVID, the only screen time she got was either watching television or doing FaceTime with a family member. She did not have her own iPad. We did not play games. None of that.
Right there with you, Valerie. Valerie lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where school has been all online since March.
Now, because her school is 100% virtual, she spends the whole day on the computer. And because it's all virtual, her teacher has relied on a lot of different technological tricks to keep the kids engaged, which I 100% understand. The only problem is it's made our daughter fall madly in love with everything technology.
Do you know what I don't like about doing school online?
That was 7-year-old Mira. Now she sees things differently. She's been plugged into a world of all screens all the time, all of a sudden. And so Mira says it's not that she's in love with technology.
You have to look at the computer the whole day, and there's so many distractions. So if you type in on Google bedroom, there would be thousands of bedrooms on Google, and you wouldn't be listening to the teacher. You could also be doing your seesaw work and not be listening to the teacher, doing Dreambox or Alexia and not listening to the teacher, and also doing emailing someone and not listening to the teacher.
So Mira is struggling to stay focused on school when it's that very same magic screen that lures her with a carnival of delights and maybe even dangers that is the internet. And before you brush off Mom Valerie with a dismissive wave of, well, just block the sites on the computer, turn on the parental controls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I am here to stand in defense of all parents who are struggling right now with questions and concerns about this brave new world of endless screen time. Because even if young Mira had access to only a couple of websites, it's the total transformation of her relationship with technology that has Valerie worried.
We have lots of struggles about trying to limit, now that she's had this Pandora's box open, trying to limit the freedoms that she has on the computer just because of the circumstances of being in a pandemic and being in a situation with 100% virtual school.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and of all the many new, untested experiences brought on by the pandemic that we've talked about for almost a year, today we're going to hone in on the complete about-face that millions of families across the country have undergone about screen time. Now, before we go any further, let me just say that, yes, the benefits of technology are many. It's the most important tool right now that's making some sort of education possible for millions of kids, and I'm not taking issue or diminishing the importance of that, but it's worth asking, what are the spillover effects of all that screen time on a child's physical and social well-being, on a child's mental development? We're essentially running a mass social experiment on kids and hoping for the best? But maybe too. As I step back from the oracle of kids and computer doom mode that, yes, I can get into, I will say we should explore what the potential upsides might be as well. So let's talk about it. And we're going to start today with Dr. Natasha Berger. She's a pediatrician and national spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics and a member of the advisory board of Wait Until 8th, a group that encourages parents to wait until 8th grade before purchasing smartphones for their children. Welcome to On Point.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So first of all, when we're talking, let's start with some definitions here. When we're talking about screen time and this new world of seemingly endless screen time that that kids are in, do you differentiate between the time that kids are spending in front of a laptop or a computer for school versus other screen time?
Well, if you've found a good way to do that, I'm all ears. I'm certainly a parent who's struggling with this as well. And those lines between screen time for school and screen time for entertainment right now are completely blurred. And it's really hard to figure that out.
Okay. And so is it troubling to you that those lines are so blurred?
As a pediatrician, knowing the detriments to a child's physical and mental health with screens, just like you have mentioned, of course it's worrisome to me. We don't want our kids to be on screens all the time. I don't think any parent wants this situation that we're in. We didn't ask for this by any means. But we also have to adjust to this new reality so that we can salvage the good parts of our relationships with screens and the good parts of the relationships with our kids as we're trying to navigate this new normal.
And just, have you been hearing about this from families that you work with, from patients?
Every day. This is one of the most common questions I'm getting in the office right now. So many parents are worried about this and really worried about how we're going to repair the perceived damage that we're doing to our kids right now, not only with screens, but in so many other ways. And there's not a lot of great solutions when we look at the evidence.
Okay, so we're going to talk about what the evidence does show in just a second. But Dr. Burgert, if you hang on here for just a second, I want to pull into the conversation Anya Kamenetz. She's NPR's education correspondent and author of The Art of Screen Time. Anya, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. This is a topic that really hits home for me. Full disclosure for everybody here in this program. Mm-hmm. But tell me, I mean, how much more, is there a way to measure, Anya, how much more screen time kids on average are getting or have been getting over the course of this pandemic?
Sure. I mean, you can talk about the 70% increase in platforms like Roblox and the ratcheting up of use of obviously educational software. So all those platforms are seeing a lot more traffic. I titled my book 2 years ago, The Art of Screen Time, because time is how we've all been conditioned to look at this. But I really, really encourage the parents don't fixate so much on hours in the day, but they think much more about how their kids are getting from the technology that they're using. And then, of course, the ways that it's not serving them. So it's really not about time on a device, but it really is about the relationship that you have to that device.
Okay, so Dr. Burgert, what do you think about that? That time is the wrong lens at which to look at this?
No, I completely agree with Anya. I think that it's really difficult to constantly be policing minutes right now, which is kind of a perspective that we've taken pre-pandemic to watch for that 2 hours a day and watch for that quality of our programmings for sure. And right now we're really focusing our conversations in the office about focusing on time that kids need to be good kids and less focus on the minutes per day they're on the screen.
Okay. So I actually am going to stick with minutes per day for a second here. For this reason, in that time, of course, is a fixed constant for all of us, right? All of us only have 24 hours in any given day. And so perhaps it's not so much of the absolute. Well, no, I do actually think the absolute minutes is something I want to hear from both of you about, because every additional minute spent in front of a screen for a kid, there's an opportunity cost for that, right? To your point, Dr. Burgert, of how much time does it take to be a good kid, right? Because they're just physically, they're still sitting there. They're sitting there for additional minutes in a day in front of a screen that maybe, say, a year ago, they weren't physically sitting there. And so they're not doing other things like playing with friends or, exploring outside or whatever kids would have done if they weren't in front of the screen. What do you think?
So I completely agree. There's deficits to that. But at least in our area with kids mainly on virtual school, that's one thing as a parent that I can't control right now. And so I want to focus on the times outside of what our kids are now required to be on those screens to focus on the positive things that I can do to build into their lives as a whole, because I can't control the 6 hours of Zoom that my kid's on right now.
Anya, go ahead.
Well, I always encourage parents to think about their day in terms of the balance that they're striking. So I really do encourage parents to guard bedtime. I know that there's a lot of bedtime drift happening, and especially with older kids, tweens and teens. So guard that bedtime, keep the devices out of the bedroom, I think is worth making a hard and fast line. Obviously, we all need physical activity. We all need outdoor time. We all need stretch breaks, parents and children. So thinking about managing your day, and then can you get a screen-free meal in at least once a day? You know, a lot of families are eating more meals together, but if we're all on our devices, we're missing that conversation time. So, you know, that's something we really try to keep sacred in our house is, you know, it could be 5 or 10 minutes, honestly, but to have two kids and two parents sitting around the table having a conversation. So really, it's not, again, it's not about policing minutes on device, but it is about what do you want to build into your day and your rhythms and your balance to,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, point well taken. But maybe let's go back here a second. Because, and Dr. Berger, I'll turn this to you. Why is it then, though, that for several years, especially for younger kids, I mean, we need to honor the fact that different kids at different ages are experiencing really different things developmentally, but especially for younger kids. And we've just got a minute before we have to take this first break, Dr. Berger. But why did the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend minimizing screen time to begin with?
The recommendations from the Academy are based on evidence. And as physicians, we always want to give advice to our parents that's based on evidence. And there have been repeated studies that show that excessive number of minutes not only displace the good things about being a kid, but put kids at risk for the damaging effects of media that any parent wants to avoid. So that was an evidence-based recommendation. It wasn't just a random number. And to Anya's point, for sure, we want to be able to watch that number even in these times.
Well, we're talking about this brave new world of what feels like to many parents, all screens all the time for their kids, and the downsides and maybe the potential upsides and the impacts that's having on millions of young people. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this hour, we are exploring what impact all that screen time is having on kids. I mean, yes, with online school and the pandemic, much of that screen time is a necessity for some kind of education. But is it having a spillover effect into the rest of childhood? I'm joined today by Anya Kamenetz. She's NPR's education correspondent and author of The Art of Screen Time. And Dr. Natasha Berger joins us as well. She's a pediatrician, a national spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics, and member of the advisory board for Wait Until 8th. And let's listen to what some On Point listeners had to say about this. This is Tom Hazard, who called us from Irvine, California. His children are 6 and 11.
I don't necessarily see that as a problem for their development or education. They're both doing incredibly well. The 6-year-old is just learning to read, and that's all great. The one thing that really does bother me that I really try to reinforce and is that they can actually put the screen down when they need to go pick something up. I find they're often like so glued to the screen, they want to hold it all the time. It's like it's attached to them.
That's Tom Hazard, an On Point listener from Irvine, California. And actually, Anya and Dr. Berger, let me ask you about that, because I think what Tom described is a very common phenomenon, at least anecdotally, that parents are experiencing this actually extreme attachment to the devices themselves. Dr. Berger, I mean, is that a problem? Have you seen it getting worse? Or is that actually just a sort of normal object attachment that kids might have to anything?
Well, for so many of these families, like have been so many of my families have been so well of limiting screen time, and that screen, that holding that iPad or holding mom's phone has been a forbidden fruit for so long because that was just as a reward or just as something that they put on the shelf when they had a few minutes of their designated screen time per day. And kids are taking a lot of ownership now with these iPads that they've been given in order to do their academic work and the devices that they've been issued from their schools that have been told that they are theirs. And I think with the innate attraction that these kids have to these screens, that ownership and that partnership becomes enmeshed and they get very attached to these devices physically as the day progresses and as these many weeks have progressed when they have had their own device.
But the question is that a problem though?
Well, I think it's a problem because there's going to be some very significant separation anxiety and some detox that's going to happen when we get our kids back into a normal school environment without having those devices in their laps all day.
Anya, jump in here. What do you think?
I think that we have a really wrong-headed attitude towards this phenomenon, and it's easy to do because there's always moral panics to come in when there's new technologies. It's very normal for kids to fixate on objects. That's a transitional object. It's a very appropriate developmental thing. It's also very appropriate for kids to love things that are fun and things that are exciting. And digital media is fun and exciting for kids. It just is. And it has been for decades and decades. Television was unbelievable, far and away, you know, the most exciting things for children in the 1950s, right? So the fact that our kids enjoy carrying around devices is not in itself a problem, even if they have separation anxiety from it. They also have separation anxiety from their beloved toys. Often those toys are based on characters that they love from the media that they love. So if we demonize it, we're not going to be able to understand it. And what we want to be able to do is help our kids develop self-regulation around things that they enjoy, right? So not to say you're bad for liking this or you're bad for wanting it, but how do we deal with the fact that we can't eat all the candy that we want all the time? Well, you have boundaries and you have rules and you talk about it and you have consequences. And then you deal with it. Hopefully you learn to manage it. And I really encourage parents to treat media in the same way. It's not radon that's going to disrupt our children's brains, but it is something that is very fun and exciting and seductive, and we all have to learn to manage it in our lives.
So point well taken that, you know, demonizing technology is a losing battle and a wrong-headed one because technology is a fact of life, an important fact of life for sure. But if I may, I think we also shouldn't underplay the deliberate design in these devices that, I mean, there's ample reporting and ample evidence from the very makers of the devices or the apps on such devices that they are very conscientiously creating an experience that, unlike my favorite Stuffy when I was 8 years old, was interactive on the devices are interactive on demand, very deliberate color schemes, very deliberate feedback mechanisms that make it hard for adults to put them down, let alone kids. I mean, I think we look at people who are sitting in front of a slot machine and constantly pulling the handle and saying, wow, that person can't step away. I mean, what difference is there between that and the way these devices are designed, especially on the rapidly developing brains of young kids?
Well, yes, they are extremely seductive and they are definitely designed to be sticky and to be enjoyable. So the question is, how do we help our kids develop self-regulation? And we can do it in two different ways. We can do it by setting boundaries and limiting their access. And we can also do it by helping them develop their own internal self-regulation, which is going to grow over time. It's going to be different for different kids. The difference between an iPad and a slot machine is that an iPad can connect you to knowledge, it can connect you to creativity, and it can connect you to other people. So it offers a whole range of benefits that, you know, simply being addicted to something like gambling cannot offer you. So I think that it's incumbent upon us to kind of think about all of the complexities of this, because I think that, you know, focusing on it as an addictive object alone is not going to give you the full range of possible responses
as
a parent.
Yeah, and no, I think that's a really good point because it's not just one thing, right? For every potential quote unquote waste of time that might come along in using these devices, there's also the opportunity for enrichment and learning. But Dr. Burgert, I'm going to guess that you've got some thoughts on this.
Well, I think it's like anything that we do as parents, I think we have to look at our kids first. And there are some kids that can do self-regulation super easily. It comes very naturally to them. And they are able to pick up those devices and able to put them back down and transition from their screen world to their real life world very easily. They're still able to naturally continually be interested in other activities and don't constantly pick it up. There's other kids, especially in different parts of their brain development, in which the addictive properties of these devices are more effective. And it does become more difficult for kids to develop those self-regulation behaviors on their own. It takes a lot of concerted effort from families and parents to really be dedicated to that in order to help kids through that and provide options and provide those boundaries. And for some parents today who are so overtaxed, who are working from home, who are having stress, who are dealing with grief, who are trying to put food on the table, that ask is really hard right now. And so I think we have to give each other a little bit of grace as well to say, of course, kids need these self-regulation behaviors, but that we need social constructs in order to help us with that. And right now, for a lot of kids, their parents are the only ones that they're really seeing and helping them with that. And the parents are struggling with this themselves. So I think in at least with my patients, a lot of that is easier said than done. And so some days are better than others. We can't do everything, but everyone can do something. So maybe it's the little small choices that we make every day that matter today.
Well, Anya, I'm going to come back to you here in just a second, but I wanted to just play a little bit of tape from Vicky Rideout. She's the head of VJR Consulting, an independent research group that's been doing national surveys on kids and media use for nearly two decades.
Children are spending more time on screens than they used to, say, 20 years ago, and they're spending more time independently on screens because they can do it themselves. It's very easy. You just touch a button. They're using different types of media a little bit than they were in the past in that it's not a TV show that they're watching as much as it is a YouTube video. So they can be watching all different kinds of content that either they can pick themselves or that the algorithm can pick for them. And they're doing it on a device where, as a parent, you may or may not really be fully aware of what it is that they're watching.
And Vicky Rideout has a very first-person experience about what she was just talking about. She has a 6-year-old grandson. And one day when she thought he was watching Scooby-Doo cartoons, she actually found out what he really was watching, which was Doritos commercials on YouTube.
And I said, why are you watching Doritos commercials for an hour? And he just looked at me and he said, I really don't know.
That's Vicky Rideout, head of VJR Consulting, who's been doing a national surveys on kids' media use for nearly two decades. So, Anya, to the point that you're making about working with children, about parental guidance, actually, when it comes to the additional screen time that we have, what are some first tips that you would have to avoid situations like even Vicky found herself in with her grandson watching an hour of back-to-back Doritos commercials on YouTube?
You know, it's so funny because I feel like I would start with that exact same question, but in a completely different tone.
Okay.
Which is, hey, what are you watching? Huh? Why is that interesting? What is it about it? How do you think that you got from that video to the next video to the next video? And so we need to build, we need to get our kids on our side. And I totally respect the idea that, you know, parents are really varying in their resources right now. And I just want to put a marker out there that you're doing okay. You know, you're worried about this, you're worried about your kids, but you're not going to screw them up. We're all in a really tough position right now. This is a harm reduction situation. But in order to, you know, assuming you have the bandwidth and assuming you have the time, starting with curiosity, starting with bridge building, and sitting down and co-viewing with your child what they're interested in will help you have so much more of a basis of open communication around boundary setting. I need to know why my daughter has gotten so into Among Us and why it is such a fun game. Because you know what ends up happening is I can say, hey, it's cool. That game is just like the game Mafia, and you can actually play it in person, socially distanced in the park. So you can take your love of this video game and you can take it off the screen. But I would not have known that if I didn't know what she was playing and why. So asking that question, not with judgment, but with true curiosity, really opens the door to a better dynamic with your children around their tech use.
Furiously taking notes here, Anya, from my whole life. Dr. Berger, would you have something to add to what she said?
I love that question. And I also like to ask kids, what did you learn from that today? And that can also really be insightful, because maybe when they were watching that Doritos commercial, what they were really looking for, and this obviously would be a stretch for a six-year-old, but maybe a little older kid, maybe looking at the cartoon itself or how the artist drew something. I've been very surprised when kids are watching what seems to be very mundane things. They're actually thinking about, well, how could I edit that video? Or let me listen to the sound on that, because so many kids are using these tools as creative outlets. And so, asking those great questions of, what are you learning? Why do you like that? Can I watch too? Show me more. Really trying to engage with those kids in those places can be very insightful and allows you to have, a little bit more compassion to them as how they're trying to navigate this space too, and understanding and maybe being able to more practically redirect them to places if you know what their purpose is by looking at something.
Well, so full disclosure here, obviously I'm a mom, and it's hard for me not to be the Chicken Little at this table, to be perfectly honest. Because, I mean, you heard from 7-year-old Mira at the top of the show, who said even while she's supposed to be doing online school, there were just so many other options that it was hard for her to stay focused on what her second grade teacher was wanting her to learn at that moment. And there were, like, you know, she talked about Roblox or doing other things on Seesaw. So it was still sort of still within the realm of educational media. But it was hard for her to stay focused. And I am curious about, I mean, I just think parents have a lot of anecdotal or just at-home experience in wondering about the spillover effects of that. And here's why I say this, because I have seen this in my own household, that it seems to me that over the past many months, when the kids in our little pod get together to play, the frequency with which I hear them, and this is them off, they're off screens and they're actually able to be safely together, the frequency with which I hear them say, all of a sudden, they'll just stop and say, I'm bored. I don't know what to do. Let's go play a game. Let's go play a video game. The words I'm bored come up much more often than I've heard before. And it makes me just wonder whether the stimulus of all that screen time is having an effect on the things that they are doing, or their ability or tolerance or patience for those things when they're off screens. I mean, I'll give you another example. Kids in the pod were playing outside on the street one day. There were no devices to be seen. And as soon as another kid, I live in a condo building, so we're all in kind of the same pod, joined the outside play, she had a phone in her pocket, and just knowing that she had the phone in the pocket, all of a sudden everyone was surrounding the phone, watching her play Among Us. So, I mean, I feel like a lot of parents might be hopefully nodding their head and be like, I've seen that too. Should we be worried, Dr. Berger?
I think that that was happening certainly before the pandemic too. And I think it speaks to how attractive these devices are. It also speaks to the game, you know, Among Us and Fortnite and these other games becoming part of the social milieu that connects these kids together. Mm-hmm. There is some connecting pieces to that that gives them some commonality, no different than you and I sharing our thoughts on a Netflix show. So I do think that helps with some of that social norming. But it also is a reflection of maybe more effort or opportunities that we have to give our kids. Of course, it's important to be bored, but when we're dealing with kids that have had so much time with tech, specifically offering them alternatives, I think can be helpful. We don't have the luxury, or most of us don't have the luxury of dropping our kids off at basketball or soccer or that kind of stuff that kind of forces them into that activity that we would prefer them to have. It gives them something to do. So maybe as parents, we can, as we're getting our pods together, think about some stuff to offer those physical options that maybe we haven't had to do so explicitly in the past. Mm.
Anya, we've just got a minute to go before the break here, but help me out here. Should I calm down?
I mean, I think everyone should calm down because this is a very anxious time and we need to be able to be present with our loved ones and look for behavior that we want to praise and that we want to encourage and to grow. So when you see your kid using their imagination, when you see them playing with objects and boxes around the house, let the mess go and kind of celebrate those moments of free play because they are very precious.
I absolutely agree. It's the decreasing tolerance for those low stimulus moments, though, that I'm wondering about. But we're going to talk a lot more about this issue when we come back from a quick break. We're discussing this hour the downsides and the potential upsides of this new world that kids have been thrust into, to what feels like all screens all the time. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Today, we're talking about kids and screen time, which has gone up for a lot of kids because they're doing school through those screens with remote school. And we're trying to get a sense as to the impact that has on the rest of a child's life and whether or not we can actually know that right now. I'm joined today by Anya Kamenetz. She's NPR's education correspondent and author of The Art of Screen Time. Dr. Natasha Berger joins us as well. She's a national spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics and a member of the advisory board Wait Until 8th, a group that encourages families to wait until 8th grade before purchasing smartphones for their children. And Anya and Dr. Berger, at the top of the show, we heard a little bit from a family with a younger child. I wonder if you could listen along with me because we want to swing sort of to the other end of the developmental spectrum and hear from a teenager. So this is Spandana Pavaluri. She's a sophomore at DuPont Manual High School in Louisville, Kentucky. And recently she took time out to walk us through her day in screens.
I wake up with my phone alarm. And so, you know, I get on my phone because I have to turn that off. But if I don't delete my social media like the night before, then I'll probably go on it. And sometimes I do delete it just so that like if I need to get up really quickly or something like that. But then I'd probably be on it for around 10 to 15 minutes. And then I'd maybe start like getting things a bit ready, maybe like making my bed and stuff like that.
So after making your bed and stuff like that, it's time for school, which for Spandana is still all virtual.
At 9 a.m., I have my first class. So I'm on the screen for like 50 minutes. And then we have like little breaks in between our classes. But usually like during those breaks, they're around like 20 minutes. So I'm either like doing an assignment online or just on like, you know, text one of my friends quickly or am on my phone for a little bit.
And then another online class. And finally, it's lunchtime.
If my parents are busy then, and usually they are because they have work, then I might just like watch TV or something. And then I have my other classes. And then after school, you know, I have a bit of time to like relax and rest and things like that. But I also have homework assignments that are virtual. So yeah, it kind of adds up.
And Spandana says that it is a lot for now, but that technology is also often the best way she has to connect with friends outside her house.
I'm really, really glad I'm able to like FaceTime them and things. And because that's a really like interactive technology, like being able to see them and hear them talk and everything. But I think there's just like nothing like just sitting together and doing things together.
That's Spandana Pavaluri, a sophomore at DuPont Manual High School in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, Anya Kamenetz, let's talk a little bit more about, is there sort of a potential social upside, as Spandana described, in this time where people can't actually see each other physically? Or should we shouldn't underplay the connections that young people can have through these devices?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more than an upside. I think it's a lifeline and a godsend for so many people, not just, teenagers and adults, and frankly, you know, of all ages. So the question is, how do we promote positive social engagement online? I push my children and myself towards real time, FaceTime, you know, video chatting versus text-based or social media feed communications. And I talk to them about digital etiquette, you know, the idea that you can misunderstand people much more easily when you're just chatting in a thread, and that it's important to know when you can talk things out, when it's important to talk things out in real time. So with these kinds of guardrails, you know, I really smile on my child, my older child, connecting with her friends over a video game with a video chat at the same time, because I think it's really the closest she can get to having fun with her friends safely when they're not able to play outside.
Mm. Dr. Berger, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. And I would also extend that to say that for some kids who are really struggling with isolation, being able to reach out through these medias can literally be life-saving to them. So I think that they're super important. Gaming has been a bigger part of the conversation, online gaming and multiplayer games throughout the pandemic from both my male and female patients. I think that that has been a really nice interaction between social interaction and them physically doing something, learning potentially a new skill. But just like your guest mentioned, you know, kind of being around that conversation, listening to that conversation, maybe when they don't know that you're listening, having those connected places in areas of the home that people could naturally walk by, so that you can kind of keep an eye on where they at and what they're doing, what kind of language they're using, and who they are connecting to online, I think is also important as people are reaching out in this way.
Hmm. Now, Anya, I know I'm really glad that we have both of you today, but Anya, especially you, because I saw your Twitter thread from was it last week or so, after the New York Times put a front page story about fears of additional screen time on the front page, and you had some strong responses to it. But let me ask you, one of the things that you tweeted about is, what is the nature of the research that either connects or doesn't additional screen time with perceived negative effects? How much research is there?
So, I did a deep dive into this for The Art of Screen Time, and I'll point to, you know, we talked about, of course, the American Academy of Pediatrics is as evidence-based as it can be, but when it comes to something like a recommendation, no screens before age two, which you may have heard, I talked to Dr. Victor Strasburger, who wrote that recommendation, and he told me straight up, we made it up. We did not have a very good evidence at the time. They revised that guideline in 2016 to say it's probably fine to video chat with grandma. It's probably fine to look at your kids, you know, to look at photos together. So there's a lot of squish in this. And one of the reasons is that if we think something is harmful for children, we don't randomly assign them to get it in an experiment.
Right, right.
So we're not going to have great evidence about the influence of things like social media use on mental health, because we're not going to do intervention studies where we assign people to use a lot of social media. So we're left with associations. Associations are very complex and confounded. I think, you know, just as Dr. Berger said, we have to know that our children, we have to watch our children. If we think our children are having symptoms of depression, anxiety, they're withdrawn, they're irritable, they're not sleeping, or they're sleeping a lot, they gain weight, then we need to watch it. And screens can be a factor in that. They can be the object of an unhealthy kind of relationship or fixation. So it's an ingredient, but I don't think it should be the thing that we fixate on.
Dr. Berger, your response to that?
Yeah, I agree. And especially with some of the families that I've been talking to that have shared these same concerns, I think screens can sometimes be a easy target, that if things are not going right, or if your kid looks really stressed out or maybe has gained weight, that is an easy target because it's something that you can eliminate as a parent if you choose to do so. But in some certain situations, like, the screens can be a solution to some of those problems, and just immediately jumping to screens as the enemy, I don't think is the right thing to do. It just, like Anya mentioned, it's one component of a very big puzzle here. And especially in our kids' lives that have been turned upside down just as much as ours, I would want families to just keep an open eye to all of the different things that surrounding them that may contribute to some of the problems that we have traditionally isolated as a screen time problem. You know, just have those conversations with your kids and have a broader lens, and not instantly have screens be the enemy.
I tell you both, I'm trying my absolute hardest not to turn this into an hour of therapy for myself and my parenting, because I hear everything that you say, and I'm so glad that you're saying it, but it's hard for me to not to have this visceral response, right, when I'm seeing my kids being on screens all day long. So, well, let's put my personal concerns aside and hear from what some On Point listeners they wanted to share with us about their views of kids and additional screen time. Here's a listener from Texas who has a third grader and a kindergartner and a three-year-old.
The middle one enjoys the Khan Academy app. He's probably learning quite a bit with that app too. The downsides, they're on screens 8+ hours, and the majority of it is just silly stuff that does not help them at all in life.
And here's Quinn Friendly in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, what I like about it is you get to look stuff up like cute puppies. You can turn them off whenever you want to. And what I don't like is they make your eyes hurt if you're on them too much. They don't always work. Like, there can be internet problems. For me, it feels like there's a little bit too much screens right now. And I would like to have about 2 hours of screen time a day, and the rest of the day play with friends.
That's Quinn, second grader in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I think we've heard in the voices of kids this hour a personal desire to self-regulate and not actually even be on those screens all that much. But Dr. Berger, quickly, Quinn talked about her eyes hurting. I know that a lot of parents have been buying, like, blue light blocking glasses. Do we know if those are effective?
We don't have a ton of evidence that those are effective. One of the things I am recommending to my families, though, is so many kids are really hunching over these school tablets that they've been given, and really having some neck problems, back problems, and getting really close to those screens. So we want to remember, just like we do in our own office spaces, let's lift up the screens to get them to eye level. Make sure that the kids are sitting upright, not hunched over a screen all day. Make sure that there's a comfortable distance. Make sure that their vision has been recently checked. Some kids are presenting with, like, they truly need glasses when they've been staring at these smaller text all day. Maybe getting a second monitor or a second keyboard to be able to make things bigger and more accessible. Kind of thinking about that comfort when you do have to spend that much time on a screen.
Well, we have some comments online here. Oregon Mama Bear says, many families in my area raised huge red flags about screen use. We returned the district issue Chromebook in January. Oregon Mama Bear says they're no longer Zooming for learning and that they do think screen time has increased exponentially for school-aged children. And then we have this interesting comment coming in from Gordon Bach, who says it may be ideal to wait until 8th for certain kinds of mobile devices, but we're ignoring half of America, families with divorced parents. If children are with the other parent, a mobile device can be a godsend. Now, Anya, I'm going to expand that sphere here a little bit and just ask, are the concerns about elevated screen time, and this is an old question, but worth resurfacing, is it sort of a concern that's a luxury for people? with certain kind of families, certain kind of incomes, certain kind of zip codes.
Absolutely. I mean, every aspect of what we call intensive mothering or concerted cultivation is a luxury. And so the idea that your child would be better off if they were scheduled in, you know, a sport and a musical instrument and in a cultural event, you know, 4 days a week, 5 days a week, that was a model that really belonged to the pre-pandemic world that we're trying to unsuccessfully port into this world. And it's really a kind of a cult of ultra productivity for parenting that does very much relate to privilege and a certain idea about how children should spend their time. So thinking about, you know, families that live in two households, maybe a child who's home alone all day doing Zoom school while their parent is an essential worker and goes out to work, or they're taking care of younger siblings. These are all reasons that a child might need to be connected and to have their own device. And it doesn't mean that it can't be harmful or it can't be too much. It just means that the ability to intervene and to have concern for kids on their digital diets is something that itself is a measure of privilege.
Mm. So we've just got about 2.5 minutes left here, and I want to dare to look into the future. I think right now something like half of kids, school-age kids in America, are doing all virtual learning. So it's a huge number. Hopefully sometime that will come to an end. Anya, I'll just give you a minute here. What are things that people ought to be thinking about, that schools and families ought to be thinking about, and what life could look like after all this online learning?
Well, some fraction of children are going to want to continue with online learning because they're thriving in that setting and they actually prefer the lack of distractions, in-person distractions. And others, I think that high schools in particular, I know I was speaking recently to, administrators group, and he said, I think that more and more students are going to want a flexible kind of education that spans both online and in-person opportunities to give you more flexibility of time and place and method of learning. So I think there's an opening toward more better kinds of technology that K-12 has really resisted for a long time. When it comes to our personal use of devices, I don't think they're going anywhere. I think we have a chance potentially to develop a more positive culture around them so that we can bend our use toward the more balanced and the more beneficial and the less kind of way that we feel shame around our devices or fixation on our devices because they're filling a need that we're not getting elsewhere. Mm.
Dr. Berger, same question to you. We've just got about 40 seconds here.
Yeah, I think that the framework and what we see in education is going to be forever changed from this point forward because of this experience that we've had during this pandemic. But regardless of screens, regardless of what the educational piece may look like, as a pediatrician, I just encourage all of my families to feed your kids well, prioritize their sleep, have them do something fun and something that makes them smile every day, and look into your kids' eyes so they know someone loves them and that they are seen. And if you can do those things, then you are going to be ahead of the game regardless of screens.
The basics, right? The basics are always
absolutely
important to remember. Well, Dr. Natasha Berger, national spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics and a member of the advisory board for Wait Until 8th, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Anya Kamenetz, NPR education correspondent and author of The Art of Screen Time. Anya, it was great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.